And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Don G. from Atascadero.
She said she was going to introduce me, but it'd be hard to live up to that introduction. I commend, by the way, my name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. I commend all the people who passed another milestone on the road of happy destiny. And the birthdays are impressive, really. As some of you know, I was a judge for many years, and therefore, I want to say that the meeting will not be extended. Or it is, or at least you will all be sitting here and I'll be gone. No one has anything that significant to say, in my view. And particularly in my case, you know, I heard, they didn't know, I guess, that I was going to, I'm sensitive, unlike the other people in AA. And I heard a young lady say, and I could hear her, you know, she's, I think my hearing is gone too, but she said, what is that old goat possibly going to say to help a swinger like me? You know, she said, a fast bicycle ride and a love affair would kill him. And that isn't true. I go pretty good on a bicycle. And I know that what I say here will not be long remembered, but I am sure you're going to remember my shoes. Some of you saw me dunking a basketball before the meeting started. I am experiencing the 1,000 natural shocks that flesh your heir to that Shakespeare speaks about as you age, and I have been a marathon runner, a motorcycle racer, a parachute jumper, done various things that have caused the spine to develop some rather strange shapes. And these shoes allegedly are to help soften the spring. So some of you may have noted how I bounced up here to the podium. It's these shoes. I probably will say a little something about alcohol since we've gathered together for that purpose. But as many of you probably have been endured my monologues over the years, know I don't spend a great deal of time giving some kind of a genealogical explanation of what I used to be like. And, you know, I hear people sometimes get up there and tell the most incredible stories about themselves. Under the guise of telling what they used to be like, they describe the things that happened to them. You know, and they flagellate themselves with their own inadequacies. And one guy, I remember, said he was driving down the street and just opened the door and stepped out of his car, you know, 30 miles an hour. I didn't do things like that on purpose. They just happened to me. And somebody did ask that I tell the one thing that seems to have gotten associated with my talk. And I will do so because they said if I don't, they wouldn't pay for the hotel room. But it did mark something of a turning point in my career of drinking. I should preface it by saying that I drank almost exclusively to relax. And on the occasion with which I will regale you, I'd been relaxed about a week. And I awakened from a fitful, tormented sleep. I have dreams of Dante's Inferno, imps of the perverse. I can virtually smell the sulfur. And I staggered to my feet, and indeed I was actually drenched with perspiration. And for a fleeting moment, I thought maybe alcohol was doing something it shouldn't to me. But then I looked down onto the couch from which I had risen, and I noticed that there was a small hole where my head had been. And I realized then that it wasn't alcohol. I had had a cigarette in my hand or mouth when I nodded off. And it had fallen onto the covering of this couch and burned its way through into the matting, into the tacking inside. Where lacking oxygen to take flame, the embers had just slowly spread over the night. And so I knew it wasn't my drinking. I had simply been barbecued. And commending myself on my perspicacity, I went into the kitchen and got a butcher knife and came back. First I tried a pitcher. I bought a pitcher of water back and tried to pour it into that little hole, producing a rather spectacular cascade on the carpet, but beyond that, nothing. So I knew that much more dramatic means were indeed demanded, so I went in and came back with a butcher knife and cut the couch open from one end to the other, spreading it out to expose the embers, and then I subdued them with the cooling balm of the water. The only thing was that produced acrid black smoke. And I stood there looking down at that. No, that's been more than 50 years ago. Over half a century. A quarter of this nation's history. And I can still remember looking down at that slashed and sodden mass and knowing almost to a certainty my wife was going to notice it. She was a very keen-eyed woman. There was little that passed her ken around that house, I want you to know. And this is pre-Al-Anon, but she was nonetheless a very good woman. She would never do anything to assail the dignity and masculinity of the head of the household. But there were times in moments of stress when she would say things to me that were unkind, cruel even. She might say, "You drunken son of a bitch, you did it again, didn't you?" But then later, when she had relaxed, she would feel great remorse at having spoken in that fashion to the breadwinner. And I wanted to spare her this, but I didn't know what to do. But for every problem, no matter how great, there is always a solution, which is wrong. And it occurred to me, this obvious what the thing to do was to get it out of the house. I mean, out of sight, out of mind, she might remember there was something on that side of the room, but get it the hell out of there. The problem was it really isn't easy to be moving a bed couch in the middle of the night when you should be checking into a sanitarium. But with that Herculean strength that comes only to the youthful, panic-stricken alcoholic, I managed to lift that brute onto my shoulder and lurch out the front door. At that time, we were living on the second floor of an apartment building that had a porch with columns. And I remember I virtually beat myself to death, caroming off the post, trying to make the turn. But ultimately, I did indeed descend into the patio. And then I realized that, like Bobby Burns' mouse, foresight had not been my long suit. There's virtually no place to conceal a couch in a typical apartment patio. So I'm standing there, legs trembling. I should be in a hospital, but I'm moving furniture. And I remembered a creek about 5 miles away. And so I staggered to my car and I hefted that brute up on top and proceeded to drive to my selected place of repose. Now this time, I don't know what time it was by now, but it was daylight anyhow. And there were people at the bus stops, briefcases and lunch pails and things. How they stay up that late, I don't know, but they're out there. And all I have ever wanted in life was dignity. I have not cavilled at disaster when I could face it with dignity. But as I drove down the street, I noticed that the people on the corners, their heads turned to follow my progress. Eyes wide. Jaws agape. I thought, by golly, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California. Until I chanced to pass an auto dealership that had a window in front that was dusty and acted like a mirror, and I got a vision of what it was these people were looking at. Here comes a guy down the street, Natalie had attired in the bathrobe, with a week's growth of whiskers, and on top of his car sets a couch, which previously had lacked oxygen enough to take flame, but going down the street, the wind was coming through it like a billows, and the flames were 30, 40 feet in the air. Now, up until that point, I had always been able to explain any conflicts I had had with society by blaming somebody else. Because it is virtually impossible to come into conflict with society without some other member of it participating. You know, I mean, if he hadn't made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him. But if I hadn't been an unguided missile coming down the street, I might have seen him make a left turn. Or if he hadn't said what he said about our president, I wouldn't have a broken nose. But on this occasion, when I returned, I found it absolutely impossible to find a way to blame my sleeping wife and children for having imperiled their lives, as they obviously had. And so it did occur to me that perhaps there was a problem with my drinking. But that's enough of that. Suffice it to say that subsequently I was to move beyond social drinking. In fact, in the latter stages, I wasn't having any conflict with society. I mean, how much trouble can you get into in a hotel room with a copy of wine and, I mean, a copy of Playboy and a bottle of wine? I mean, you know, if the maid doesn't step on you, you're reasonably safe. The only thing is, of course, you're dying in there. So I eventually tried AA. I gave my first AA talk in 1955. There were probably one or two people who weren't even born then. I don't know. You should have heard it. It was wonderful. If I could have stayed sober. Because at that time, I could wrap AA up into a little intellectual capsule that people might swallow it and pass a miracle. And they simply refused to do so. My first AA, first talk, at the very first meeting that I recall was the Beverly Hills Men's Stag. And that's a point-to-finger, five-minute pitch meeting. And it's held on Wednesday night. And being Wednesday, I'd been drunk all weekend, of course, but by Monday, I'd tapered off quite a bit in Monday. Tuesday, I think I even had some chili. At least I had a grouping on my shirt. And so Wednesday, I wasn't in really bad shape. I mean, I wasn't sitting on my hands. I'm very quick, but beyond that, I wasn't in too bad shape. And I was really impressed with these people. Chuck Chamberlain was there, who had a few years, and Jack Bailey, who did the old Queen for a Day for some of you older folks. These were a group of bright, intellectual people, and I was extremely impressed by them. And at the end of the meeting, the leader looked around and he said, "Well, let's see, who will we get to close it? How about the young fellow with the shiny black hair?" I was your humble servant in 1955. And he said, "Would you like to get up and close it?" I said, "Certainly." Yeah, I've been a member now for 3/4 of an hour. and I'm a very fast study. Chameleon-like, I take on the hue of every environment in which you cast me. In jail, you know, I look around and see, hard as the stick here. So I rattle this butt off screw. You know, terrified somebody's going to put the arm on me, but in AA, I can see that humility was the gig. Now, I cannot humble any clown in the house when I put my mind to it. So I had 5 minutes. I got up. I gave them a couple of minutes of pathos, a couple of minutes of humor, ended on a rising note of hope, and they gathered about me to touch the hem of my garment. And some guy came up to me and said, "Don, you haven't spoken out at the Arroyo Seco recently, have you?" Now, having drunk my way down from San Francisco with a brief stop for some undergraduate work at Camarillo Mental Hospital, I had no idea what the Arroyo Seco was. So I was reasonably certain I hadn't spoken there. And he said, "I'm leading the meeting next," whatever day it was in the following week. He said, "Would you come out and be my main speaker?" I said, "Certainly. Always glad to help the poor devil crushed by the juggernaut demon rum." And if you have 50 minutes, you can give them a little more humor, a little more pathos, end on a really soaring note of hope, and you'll get 2 invitations for every talk you make. Well, within a month or two, I was bigger in the San Gabriel Valley than Chuck C. I stayed sober for 2 years on the novelty of applause and a solid bowel movement. Why do people giggle at that? As a result of a fever I had during the war years, this was a curse. If you haven't had it, you who are made of sterner stuff, you won't know the sense of worth, the rise in self-esteem. Yea, verily, that sense of manly virility, the first time you're able to break wind without fear of following through. That alone should get you 1 birthday cake. The only thing is that if you haven't gotten a sponsor, haven't taken the steps, haven't done anything about reading the book, haven't done anything about changing your life, the novelty of even that is going to wear off. And so after a couple of years, I was taken drunk. I came back, and this repeated. And people would say to me, "I used to count my birthdays. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. You know, I couldn't get through that 3rd year. And they'd say, "Don, you have to get into your inventory." And I would take out plume and paper and go up my stream of consciousness looking for character defects, and I'd still have trouble. And they'd say, "Well, you have to work with a newcomer." So I'd drag them off the bar stools, ready or not, alcoholic or not, and I'd still have trouble. And they'd say, "Well, you've got to get more spiritual." And I would pursue God up and down the byways of the San Fernando Valley and still have trouble. And then about 41 years ago, I decided to quit drinking. Haven't had any trouble since. It's really incredible how long you can stay sober if you don't drink. And AA, as with society in general, has made some changes over the course of those years. Almost all of them, as far as I can see, are improvements. But, I noticed a couple of people who introduced themselves as newcomers. I think I heard a couple of them maybe say, "I'm an alcoholic addict." You know, and that's kind of redundant. I mean, that's like saying, "I live in San Jose and in California." I spoke at a meeting one time where a guy ahead of me was a chain smoker at a convention, and he said, the thing I hate about AA today is that people say they're talking about their being addiction. I want you to know I'm no addict. And I thought, I guess, you know, he thinks of nicotine and alcohol as vitamins or something. So that you have to go through that period of redundancy. If necessary, it's okay. In fact, I spoke one night at a little meeting, strange little meeting in Hollywood. Really a lot of strange little meetings in Hollywood. But this was called Anything Goes or What Have You or Up Yours or something like that. And they got up and identified themselves, not just with the I'm an alcoholic addict, they began to name their chemical of preference. You almost had to be a pharmacologist to follow some of them. And one lady got up, very affluent looking. I mean, you could tell she had money because she was dressed like a whore. And I mean, you wouldn't go out on the street dressed like that unless you were had a lot of money or intended to make some on the street. But she said in a haughty voice, I'm only into freebase cocaine. My heart just rushed out to her. I thought, the poor dear, she'll never know the joy of a week's run on Muscatel. But I suspect that that isn't the case. If something else isn't available, we will find something that is. I don't know anything about the better living through chemistry of chemicals. When I was young, hard to believe it now, looking like a gentle old fella. When I was young, if I walked into a room where people were giggling, they ate their cigarettes. And I never knew why. they took me for the man or something like that. And even as an antiquity, that still occurs. I was speaking down in Colonia, there outside of Oxnard one night, and I had made the mistake of taking the directions from the secretary, so I was lost. And I tried to find my way there, and I saw a guy standing on a street corner, friendly, obviously, standing on a street corner there, and I, because when I pulled over, they rushed up to the car, and I gathered there was some kind of a very small party going on because they had a little balloons in their hand. And when I asked in my best Castilian, don't they have alcohol? They ate the damn thing. So I guess I have just missed out on that world, which is probably just as well. I might not have survived it, moderation being a rumor to me. I should really swing into what has happened since I have been on the program, because that really is, my story is probably in some ways more dramatic, in other ways no different than anyone else's. Because the things that are going to happen to you on the program are unpredictable and almost without exception, miraculously good. You're going to be forced to accept the possibility of happiness. You know, I mean, I know that terrifies the newcomer, but you know, most of us wouldn't cross the street if we thought it would make us feel better. I can stay right here. I can take it as long as you can, you bitch. But happiness can be endured, and even contentment is not intolerable. But I had a difficult time, obviously, when I first came around with the background I had had. And I had a hard time getting back into the law. I had been in AA long enough to have been told that our stories can be the source of innocent merriment. What I had not been advised of is that the non-alcoholic will rarely see the humor in them. And so once I got squared away with the bar and was looking for work, I interviewed a member with this large law firm, and I thought I'd tell him a few little icebreaker stories. I mean, not big boffo stories, but, you know, like the time I got drunk and threw my mother-in-law down the steps or something like that. and fell after her and got a hernia. You know, some little thing. He didn't titter a tig, giggle a gig. He just looked at me. And I thought, I guess I'm being too subtle for him. So I told him about the time I was in four-point restraint and vomited straight up. And that got a reaction. And so finally, I said, well, look, I'm not asking you to recommend me. He said, recommend you? Recommend you? I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things that you've done or had happened to him, the things that have happened to you. When members of this law firm go into a courtroom, they represent strength in the face of adversity, determination, and grit. Send you? Never. I'll tell you, I was crushed, absolutely crushed. I had not anticipated that. If I could have slithered like a serpent across the floor, under the door, out to the nearest bar to drown the shame of that in that bottomless bottle like I always did, I'd have done it. But I thought, if I do that, that fellow will be right. He'll be right. I can't take it. And I won't give that fellow the satisfaction. I went out and drank coffee at him. About 10 years later, that guy took the check protector and one of the secretaries and fled to Paris. Disgraced his law firm, disgraced the legal profession, disgraced his family, disgraced the city of Pasadena. One of the most beautiful pyrotechnic displays of misconduct I ever saw, and he did it cold sober. On the other hand, 20-some years later, the governor of our state called me and told me he was going to appoint me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office ever held by a sober alcoholic, at least in the state of California. You know what happened for the next 15 years when I entered a courtroom and members of that law firm were there? They stood up and they remained standing until I told them they could be seated. All power to the powerless. And yet I hadn't really changed all that much. I mean, I didn't drink, which is the greatest change that can come into the life of an alcoholic. I'd learned to laugh at myself, which, by the way, should you fail to do it, will probably cause you to miss the greatest joke in your generation. But beyond that, I remained quite the same outlook on life as I had. We really do not change all that much, in my view, after you come into AA. Our traits remain much as they were, but they're now put to good use. Sometimes you'll hear people, a newcomer will say, I came into AA, you know, and immediately made a 360-degree turn. And I think, your geometry isn't very good, but by golly, you're probably closer to the truth than you think. If you can just rip yourself off one degree from your past course, one damn degree, it's going to feel like your life is being torn asunder. But if you can get off one degree and stay there for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, you're going to be so far removed from where you would have been that you're beyond belief. And, you know, I look at the people in AA, and Bill Wilson, he didn't change all that much. He was a goer, a boomer, a put-together of deals. Other guys who got sober through Buckman's Oxford group, they were content to get sober. Not Bill, just going to write a book, make $1 million. His character defect gave us probably the greatest organization of the last century. Chuck Chamberlain, although probably you people of sick trance Gloria Mundi, you probably don't even know who he is anymore, but he was the most spiritual man known everywhere in the world. And yet, he didn't change all that much. I knew the old-timers in Beverly Hills. They'd say, when we came into a bar, we'd say, buy the house a drink, and then we'd see Chuck and say, but not that damn preacher. I don't want to get him started. And yet, he did more to inspire people than anybody I know. Clancy. I knew Clancy when he hit L.A. with no teeth. You know, he was a flim-flam man of the most incredible order. We voted him out of the 6300 Club. He would sell people anything. But he got sober, and he has helped more people than anybody I know. And he's still a flim-flam man. But he's the greatest speaker around. You know, he brings them in, and by gosh, I think I'm, he and I have been, of course, known each other a long time. I think I'm the one that he talks about when he, because when I get a guy, I not only couldn't answer his questions, I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about. I used to take him out to Clancy's house, and late at night, put him up on the front porch, ring the doorbell, and run. After they'd been sober a few years, after he worked with them and day and night, they could see through him, and then I would take him back and make him into a gentleman. But, you know, Clancy was always able to one-up me and everything. I was talking about that. Whenever I would complain about something, I'd say, God damn, I spoke back in Minnesota and got snowed in, and I feel just terrible. And say, oh, I know what it is, Don. I just got back from New Zealand. We're in the air for 28 hours. Oh, screw you, Clancy. The only time I ever really, I think, got up one on them was we used to go to each other's meetings then. The Civic Group was not quite the paramilitary organization it is now. I had a meeting in Hollywood, and we used to go to each other's meetings. And mine was another one of those short 5-minute point of finger meetings. And at the end of each of our meetings, as secretaries, we would give our announcements summarizing what these inarticulate but sincere people had been trying to say. And one night, Clancy was called on at my point-of-finger meeting. He got up, he talked about how he'd been working all day down at the office and taking all kinds of phone calls from people. And then he had met this newcomer and had to go to the meeting. And afterwards, he was going to meet another guy and listen to an inventory. And he said, I won't get to bed, I'm sure, till after midnight. But when I do, finally, I will hear a little voice that says, Clancy, you are worth saving. And so when I gave my announcements, I said, you know, I've been laboring in front of a hot bench all day, and I had to come down here and set up this meeting, and I got to break it down. When I finally get it all done, I got to drive clear out to the coast and stand outside this cuckoo bird's window and say, Clancy, you are worth saving. But I really did not change all that much. I stood in front of a bench in handcuffs, charged with felonious assault and guilty. And I sat on a bench and looked down at people in handcuffs, charged with felonious assault and guilty. And the view is much better looking down. I sat on the California Supreme Court, and 7 of us in our black robes, 6 deadly serious outwardly as well as inwardly. 1 thinking in there, oh God, if they could see me down at the Al-Anon Club tonight. And when I would write a decision, it would become binding law throughout the United States, throughout California, on 33 million Californians, and we published in every law library in the country. And I would find AA coming into my decisions. You know, we have our own language here in AA. We may think we don't, but we have a liturgical way of speaking. I mean, you're in a grocery store and you're getting lining up to go out. No, no, go ahead, easy does it. No, first things first. No, yeah. Oh, you're a friend of Bill. Yeah, and so I would find, even in my writings, that would begin to come in. In the law, we say his complaint sounds in tort, or it sounds in contract, or it sounds in equity. I don't know why we say that. Blackstone probably said it 300 years ago, and somebody said, that's a grabber. But that's what we're saying. He's trying to state his cause of action in that field. And I wrote, appellate, there would be no point in analyzing an appellate's complaint in detail. Suffice it to say, it sounds in self-pity and resentment, but saves no cause of action known to the law. Another time I said, in law as in life, half measures availeth nothing. And my colleagues say, where do you get those expressions? I don't know. They pop in sometimes. So I really haven't changed in some ways all of that much. And yet, like those other people that I described, my character traits, Clancy's salesmanship, Chuck Chamberlain's spirituality, Bill Wilson's putting together of books and deals, I was a loner, an isolator. Ideas are more important to me than people. I don't get emotionally involved. Those are the very things that apparently led to my being able to do something good through the law. I hope so, anyway. I've been retired now for about 8 years. Still judgmental, but but that isn't really significant. What is significant is that I have aged, obviously. I don't have a lot of years left. One of my sons, one time, I said to him, you know, I'm getting old. He said, no, you're not, Dad. You're not getting old. You are old. How sharper than a serpent's tooth is the sting of an ungrateful child. But it's really true. It is really true. And I think, though I regret many of the things that I did that caused pain or damage to other people, I regret much more of the things I didn't do. The years that I wasted in dull, sodden drunkenness, accomplishing nothing, seeing nothing, doing nothing. I traveled around the world one time in a merchant marine after I got out of the Air Corps, and I didn't see anything. People would say to me, have you been to Singapore? Have you been to Bombay? And yeah. Well, did you see the Temple of Sun? No, I didn't see anything. All I saw was the waterfront. You know, I could have had the same fun going to San Pedro and paying somebody $20 to hit me with a board. Since I have been sober, my wife and I have done all sorts of things. We've hiked in the Alps. We've gone down the length of the Grand Canyon in a river. The Grand Canyon River on a raft. I've run marathons. I raced motorcycles. Got through the male menopause, racing with Steve McQueen out in the desert. The only copy of the big book they used to see out around Barstow. On and on. Did free fall parachute jumping, scuba diving. You know, I know you're supposed to take lessons before you scuba dive, but I'm one of those hum a couple of bars, I'll pick it up types. Jumped in off Catalina Island, it stayed down so long I ran out of air. You know, I give my higher power a real test. That is a nice thing. We have the greatest, our higher power is the greatest scapegoat known to man. I haven't made a single mistake in decades. No deviations from the path of valor or rectitude, not the faintest faux pas have I been guilty of. On the other hand, God has seen fit to do through me some of the dumbest, most petty, egomaniacal, self-centered, aggrandizing things you could imagine. But if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, who are you to criticize? Take it up with him. Other speakers are going to tell you that what they say is their own opinion. That's not true with me. I've taken the third step. What I tell you is the word of God. You better listen up. The only problem is he keeps changing his message continually, making me look like a boob for having misconstrued it in my last talk. But really, as I say, what I would recommend to people is to get out and begin living now. Even you young people, you don't have that much time. I mean, we rise like bubbles in champagne, pop, we're gone. The wink of a celestial eye of 50 years from now, nobody in this room is going to be alive. Even you young ones. Yeah, if you want to do something to help society, to improve it, you got to do that right now. Nobody raises their hand for righteousness' sake in the tomb. If you want to do something loving, tender, lewd, lurid, you have to do that right now, too. A poet said, the grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. It has to be done right now. Another poet, I'll get off with this, he said, the bird of time has but a little way to flutter, and the bird is on the wing. My bird doesn't have very much longer to fly. I don't want to miss a single beat of those wings. I hope you young folks will stick around and we'll fly together. Thank you.